Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets. My not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. A blustery and stormy Sunday here in the desert and across much of the Southwest. Actually, it finally feels like November after weeks of sunny skies and temps in the 70s or so. But as we know, on those nights when it's cold and windy and a little spooky outside, it's a great night to be inside listening to the radio, even if inside means inside your car or truck as you slice through the inky darkness on your way to who knows where. A couple of folks have already sent me photos of a log burning in the fireplace and the dogs already inside the house, so clearly we've got some folks out there paying attention. Here's what we've got cooking for the next four jam-packed hours. Students of UFO and ET lore know that strange encounters seem to follow families. That's the story. Anyway, the same families experience the same things over generations. It's as if this unknown, whatever it is stalking certain bloodlines. Well, tonight we kind of reverse the table on the unknown with a bloodline that investigates the paranormal. A father and son team that not only broadcasts about weird stuff, but pursues boots on the ground, in-your-face investigations. In the case of the father, it's a lifelong obsession. I guess I can call it that. And it includes some of the best-known paranormal cases of all time. Ghosts, if you want to call them that, poltergeists, aliens, dark entities that are known by many names, seen in many forms. I'll let you decide what to make of these cases, but Paul Eno has certainly walked the walk. And since 2005, his son Ben has been part of the team. They co-host a radio show called Behind the Paranormal, which airs in the northeastern U.S., and both have been here on the program before, but not with me. So tonight they return to share with us stories from one whopper of a book, one that explores connections between the various phenomena that we discuss on this program and ones that they have been chasing for a long time. And they have sort of a master diagram for how it might all fit together. The subtitle of the book is Everything You Know Is Wrong. So that's a pretty high bar they've set. We'll find out if that's true. First, though, well, here's a career path that not many people have followed, from singer-songwriter to rock star to environmental activist to member of Congress. Many of you will know the name of my first hour guest. Many more of you will know the songs he wrote as a member of the group Orleans. He lived the whole rock star life for a while, then channeled his talents in different directions. First, trying to help protect the environment, and then serving in a couple of political offices, ended up serving two terms in Congress. And he says the fact that he's no longer on Capitol Hill probably is a difference between life and death for him. John Hall will join me just a few minutes from now. His new book takes its title from one of his hit songs, Still the One, A Rock and Roll Journey from Congress and Back. A couple of news items to mention. Reactions continue to pour in after longtime Cuban strongman Fidel Castro died this weekend. Cubans filled the streets of Havana and will start a week-long commemoration that will culminate with a state funeral a week from now. Kind of a mixture of sadness and uncertainty there. Around this country, especially in South Florida, former Cubans largely celebrated Castro's death, wishing him good riddance. World leaders, of course, are wondering what comes next, whether the thaw in relations with the U.S. will continue. Another matter, this is out of Washington this time. I keep reading these online stories about how, on his way out the door, President Obama is going to spill a bunch of UFO secrets. Disclosure. Here you go, folks. Here are the stashed saucers. Any day now. Tell you what, those of you who believe this is going to happen, go ahead and hold your breath. Starting right now. Let me know how that goes. On the newly revamped Coast website, webmaster Greg Bishop and I have put together our usual assortment of items and oddities culled from various media around the world. We call it Knapp's News. You can find it by going to the website homepage, click on the news icon up there near the top, then under articles, And there they are, included in tonight's stories, former NSA operative Edward Snowden, the guy who spilled the beans about the massive domestic surveillance operation, all that metadata mining the government's been doing, listening to your cell phone calls and reading your emails and all of it going into a gigantic computer database. That guy, he might be testifying, not here, of course, but in Germany, that country whose officials are investigating a spying operation since they, too, were targeted. And it looks like they want to hear from Snowden in person. So at least some of the discussion underway is he might leave Russia and head for Germany, which is, you know, kind of a risky venture, I'd say. You can read the story on the Coast site. Also there, what will the Earth look like in 500 years, assuming we're still here, I guess? We've got a story that speculates about possible scenarios, pretty entertaining, and a story about an issue on which conservatives and liberals might be able to agree, the question of animal research. That plus some more exotic matters related to our program tonight. Check out Naps News on the Coast website. While you're there, you can look into how to become a Coast Insider. The cost is pennies a day. It gives you access to a vast archive of previous programs. You can listen anytime you want, as often as you want, on any device. And you can get information also on how to subscribe to George Norrie's Beyond Belief TV program. It covers many of the topics that we explore on this show. Lots of good stuff there on the website, and some of you might need to practice navigating the new setup. With that, let's assume the position. Bring in the dog and cat, put on a steaming hot pot of joe, toss a log onto the fire, slip into those jammies and bunny slippers, plop yourself down on the couch or the barca lounger, turn down the lights and turn up the radio, because we're about ready to rumble. In a moment, John Hall. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. John Hall is a musician, songwriter, singer, and recording artist who's worked with music legends ranging from Janis Joplin and Bonnie Raitt to Chet Atkins, Little Feat, James Taylor, and many others. In 1976, his song Still the One was a worldwide hit for the band Orleans. They had many other hits that you would know off the top of your head. In 1979, he co-founded Musicians United for Safe Energy along with Bonnie Raitt, Jackson Browne, and Graham Nash. And then he veered off into politics, served in a couple of local positions in New York, and then two terms in Congress. His new book is called Still the One, A Rock and Roll Journey from Congress and Back. Welcome to the program. Hey, John, good to have you here.
Hi, George. It's really good to be here with you.
So let's talk about the title of the book, the subtitle, A Rock and Roll Journey from Congress and Back. It almost makes it sound like you were in a forum.
Somebody sent you a wrong word there.
Okay.
A rock and roll journey to Congress and back.
To Congress and back. Well, the question I was going to ask still works then. It almost sounds like it's an exotic, faraway land.
Right. It is an exotic, faraway land. I think many of us have a sort of a near reality and then a sort of overview of reality, then a macro reality. And then, as your intro is saying, there's like many, many further macro realities that we may choose or not to accept or to believe in. But you know, my life, the music business is one. My life, my family life, and just making a living and trying to stay healthy is another. My being concerned with my cellular well-being is one smaller one, et cetera. And then Congress is a larger one, but has an effect on, or can have an effect on, a lot of those others. So it's really interesting. And by the way, as a native of Elmira, New York, I just wanted to say that Rod Serling would want me to say hi.
Well, the listeners of this program are certainly familiar with his body of work. You know, I was thinking to myself as I read your book, it's one thing to tell people that you were a rock and roll star and you lived that life till the fullest and all that that means. It's another to tell them you used to be in Congress. Now, that's real bravery, given the temper of the times.
Well, yeah, it's true. A temper of any time, sometimes worse than others. But I got to the point around 2005 when I had already served in the county legislature and on the school board for 4 years, two of those as president of the Board of Education. And in that job, you don't get paid anything. There's no benefits, no pay. You have to leave the dinner table while your family's having dinner and settling in for the evening, and you get to run down to the administration building and vote on how much property tax the levy is going to be and where it's going to be spent, and do you have advanced placement languages or math, or do you spend more money plowing more parking lots or more driveways, or do you hire more teachers, do you buy new instruments for the band? All these things which are important and have their own constituencies, and no matter what you decide, somebody's going to be mad at you. But all of this, you know, all of this you do for nothing. I mean, it's a really the most basic form of democracy, I think, because one does not run as a member of a party, but as an individual. So you have to convince your neighbors, basically, that you're the guy or the gal who's the best one to do this for the next 3 years. And it is great preparation because it makes you learn to build consensus and to put together coalitions.
I'll come back to Congress because I have a lot of questions about it, but let's talk about the journey first. I mean, it is an unusual path, I guess, just in a sheer number sense. In a sense, it does make sense. You wrote in the book that in early life, you knew you liked being in front of an audience. You were a bit of a ham, and it's the same feeling that drives a lot of people who end up in Congress, but not many of your colleagues there were performers, or at least not noted musicians. I wonder why not?
Well, you know, being a musician is a harder job than most people realize. Being a successful one, still harder. I tell people, young kids, you know, if they ask me if they should follow their dream into music, I tell them, if you have to ask me, don't do it. And it's really the same response to kids who say, or to young people who said, I'm wondering if I should go into politics. I say the same thing. If you have to ask me, don't do it. Although I may be a little more encouraging now than I was, because I think we as a whole, as a society, need that. And we need more and more young blood to come into the system. But it's a very steep pyramid, just like ballet or like sports. There are a lot of people who try. There are some who manage to get sort of successful, and a very, very few who get to the top. And by the top, I mean being able to do it full time and make a living at it and make some kind of impact. So I think I had an advantage, and it's the same advantage. Let me just, you know, I don't mean to compare myself in other ways to President-elect Trump, for instance, or to former President Ronald Reagan, but or to Sonny Bono, who is a congressman and former mayor of Palm Springs. But they were all TV personalities, movie personalities. In Donald Trump's case, it was a TV reality show. But they all got used to being the product, you know, where you have to get up and sell people on your, you know, the idea of you as the focus and why people should not turn the channel or why they should subscribe to your show during your time slot, why they should pay to come see your whatever it is you're doing.
Yeah, hey, I gotcha. I work on television. Well, this is a radio show. We understand that reasoning.
So in that sense, you are the product, and you develop a thick skin. You develop a knowledge that you're never as good as your best reviews, and you're never as bad as your worst reviews, and the truth is somewhere in between, and you just keep working. And so I in that sense, it's great preparation. It's also good because I'm used to being in front of thousands of people and or even millions as right now, but visually, you know, doing a very large concert, which I've done a few of, in front of hundreds of thousands of people, it doesn't faze me, nor does improvising faze me. In fact, I love improvising. So that's an advantage. So campaigning, I think I have an advantage. When it comes to being actually in office and governing, that's where the entertainer runs into trouble. I think all of us, and we need help, and we need it fast. And in my case, it's only one out of 435 members of the House of Representatives. And I went through orientation for 3 weeks, which they call drinking from a fire hose, because you're getting seminars every day and lectures every hour on the hour on every different topic, from passing a bill to getting an offset to pay for it, to putting a staff together out of 2 feet, a 2 foot thick stack of resumes, to foreign affairs, to how to handle the military and veterans in your district, and how to handle and fund your district offices versus your DC offices, the interns you're out in both, how you're allowed to use them, what kind of supervision they use, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Which committees do you want? Which subcommittees of those committees do you want? And of course, you ask for the ones, mostly you would think, the ones that you want, but there are some you're not going to get. So in those cases, whoever is teaching you or breaking you in or orientating you will say, don't ask for armed services if you're a freshman. You'll never get it.
So ways and means.
Something that you might get, like transportation and infrastructure, which, by the way, is very important and instantly applicable to any district, especially a commuter district like the one I represented. So, I did get a couple of the ones that I asked for, and Veterans Affairs being the other one. And it was really good advice that I had to do that.
We'll come back to Congress, because I want to ask you about what it was like when your fellow congressmen realize, hey, you're that rock star guy, because there's some funny stories there. But I want to get into a little bit. We're going to take a break in about 3 minutes, but spend the next couple of minutes talking about your early days as a starving artist. You know, you go to New York City and, you start working and trying to make a living at being a musician. You encounter some amazing people pretty early in your career. Talk about that period a little bit.
Okay.
Well, I'm asking you to tell me a little bit about it. Yes, James Taylor, Todd Rundgren, Danny Kortchmar.
Anyway, so, I took a Greyhound to New York City from Georgetown, where I did my first professional gig, and me and my other guitar player, Teddy Spilios, headed to the Cafe Wa in Greenwich Village and started playing in various bands there, which wound up being a band called Kangaroo. And we would alternate with different bands at the Cafe Wa, where we passed the audition, needless to say. And sometimes we alternated sets with the Castiles, the group that Bruce Springsteen was the leader of, or with the Hello People, or with various other groups. Across the street from us, Bob Dylan and Tim Hardin would be having a beer at the Kettle of Fish. And next door, the Fugs and David Bromberg were playing. And around the corner of the cafe, at the Night Owl Cafe, the Love and Spoonful had just left for the big time because their song, Do You Believe in Magic, had just become a huge hit. And they were off for the concert venues where we all wanted to go. And the new band that was sort of the house band at the Night Owl was called The Flying Machine, the lead singer being James Taylor, the first lead guitar player being Danny Kortchmar, who went on to play lead with, of course, with James and Carole King, and with played the guitar, co-wrote and co-produced many great solo records by Don Henley and others. And the bass player became a good friend of mine, Zach Wiesner, wherever he is, blessings on Zach. And he was the son of science advisor for President John F. Kennedy. It was a small kind of world, I mean, in a way that who knew I would be playing bass with the son of a president's science advisor all those years before I wound up being somewhat involved in federal government.
Jimi Hendrix walks in to see you at one point.
Jimi Hendrix came in to see us and watched a whole set, sat in the front row, right in front of our lead guitar player. I was playing bass in that band. I played bass and guitar and drums and keyboard and horns and so on. So in that band, I played bass. And Jimmy came in and sat, listened to the whole show, and I was honored that he liked it enough to stay for the whole show. And then he was playing around the corner as Jimmy James and the Blue Flames, backing up John Hamp, the blues man, over at the Cafe Agogo, and playing just the most killer blues. I mean, think about...
John, I'll tell you what. We're going to wait a second. We're going to take a break here, and then when we come back, continue your story about Jimi Hendrix, but also an introduction to a young lady named Janis Joplin, and you end up writing a song for her. We're talking with John Hall about Still the One, a rock and roll journey to Congress and back. Little Richard takes us into the break with Lucille. Light My Fire was a number one hit for the Doors back in 1967, a mega hit. And then Jose Feliciano, a year later, took a mellow version of that same song up to the top of the charts, I think to number three. Then the Doors re-released the song. I'm just playing it because it's such a great tune, and it's kind of like musical comfort food for uncertain times, kind of like musical mac and cheese for right now. We're talking with John Hall. You know him from the band Orleans. He's had some mega hits and worked with many of the greats in the musical business. We'll continue hearing some of those stories of that special time for him, and then learn how it led him to Congress. We'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM. So, John Hall, before the break, you're telling us a story about playing in this place in New York City. Jimi Hendrix is playing around the corner. He comes and checks out your show and loved it. If you want to continue that story, that's great, but I want to segue into Janis Joplin because that becomes sort of an important factor in what happens to your career.
It was a tangent that turned me into a whole other kind of musician, but I just wanted to mention during your segues, Jose Feliciano, who did that lovely version of Light My Fire, also did a great version of Dance With Me.
Oh.
I don't believe he recorded it, but it's on YouTube. It's just one of those spontaneous things he did on stage, and I wanted to mention it because I thought, as the writer of the song, that it was a killer. And at any rate, Janis Joplin did an interview with my wife, Johanna, at the time, my ex-wife, who was writing for the Village Voice, and they hit it off over lunch, and the interview continued at our apartment on the Lower East Side, and Janis heard some songs that I had written lyrics and music to, and said to Johanna, "You're a writer, you know, he's a musician, why don't you guys write me a song?" And so we did, and it was called Half Moon. We drove out to California with our white station wagon with everything we had in it, and taught the song to her and her Full Tilt Boogie Band with Todd Rundgren as musical director, although when I was there teaching the song, we didn't really need a musical director, but there was a great assemblage of talent in her living room. And she loved the song so much that she did every show until she passed away. She played it on the Dick Cavett Show. She played it on the train trip across Canada. And fortunately, recorded it on Pearl, her last album that she made. And it was the B-side of Me and Bobby McGee. So all of a sudden, I went from a guy who was, you know, a good bar performer and a good college gig performer, and who had done some Broadway and off-Broadway work, to a guy who had hidden a rock song that was in the day of freeform pop radio, when people would play deep into the albums. They would play album tracks or B-sides or whatever on the radio. Half Moon was not as well known as Me and Bobby McGee, but it was certainly very well known, and also covered by Chaka Khan and various other artists. James Brown did a organ instrumental of it, and so all of a sudden they had those credentials, and one thing led to another, and I wound up playing guitar behind Seals and Crofts and Taj Mahal, and going to Europe, opening to Santana on a tour that I was backing up, being the guitarist for Karen Dalton, a singer who, I'm sorry to say, passed away a while back also. But we got bumped off that tour. It's a long story. I'll keep it short and say that I came back to Woodstock, where we had moved in the meanwhile, and decided I wanted to be a front man, not a side man, and I wanted to be doing my own songs, not covers of somebody else's songs, and not a hitman anymore, not the paid hired gun who would play guitar with anybody, but to play and sing as part of a band. And that band started out in as a trio in the January '72. Wells Kelly, Larry Halpin, and myself did our first date as Orleans. A few months later, when Lance Halpin, Larry's younger brother, graduated from college, he came up and auditioned in New York, up in the Hudson Valley, in the Woodstock area, for us, and immediately joined the band. And the Halpin brothers had that brother blend, like the Everly Brothers or the Louvin Brothers or the Jackson Five or the Staple Singers, you know, those families that all sing together so they all sound the same and have that harmony that won't quit. And so we had that on top of a lot of very hard rehearsed and thoughtfully worked out arrangements and kind of funky rhythm section. And that was where Orleans started out.
Dance With Me, Still the One. You had a bunch. You sold a bunch of records.
Yeah, Reach a Little Bit Higher, Let There Be Music. And then there's a song that I wrote for the No Nuke record that was his first big, really big environmental show that I was involved in. And Orleans recorded that song as well as the version that I recorded on the No Nukes album with the Doobie Brothers, James Taylor, Michael McDonald, and many other great players and singers joining in.
You become an activist because it's a story you tell in the book about having a battle with the guy with the neighborhood junkyard.
Yeah, right.
It kind of gets you fired up. Which, you know, you can almost see a mental arrow leading from that to, toward activism involving in nuclear energy.
There is a line connecting the two. And, you know, first of all, water contamination, as we know now, much better than I knew then, is a big issue and probably one of the biggest issues we face in the future, having clean drinking water available for hopefully for everybody. And so I was worried that these junk cars being destroyed next door would be not only ugly, but that they would be draining petroleum products, acids from the batteries, antifreeze and other liquids into the groundwater. And we were all drinking water from wells. So all the neighbors and I were up in arms about it. When we got that problem solved, we had to deal with the county trying to build a giant 200,000 tons of garbage a year for 20 years dump in our town on the last undeveloped farm in the town. And then, you know, one thing led to another, and we managed to stop that partly because, it was a public outcry against it. And was also educating the county legislature about different kinds of soils and about the aquifers running underneath and that carried that clean drinking water to the city of Kingston, where most of them lived. And so sooner or later, self-interest becomes the public interest if you really step back and look at the big picture. And that's what I hope people will do. Not to get political on this show too much, but that's what I hope people will do with climate change, is to sit back, you know, take a long enough view to see where your interest is the same as the public interest. And it will, believe me, it will converge. The question is whether we make that decision and start doing something about it in time.
You become really concerned about nuclear power, and there was a facility that was planned for someplace near where you lived. And so you unite with and help form Muse, this Musicians United for Safe Energy, with Bonnie Raitt and Jackson Browne. And there's a photo in the book of you on the cover of Rolling Stone with some pretty interesting company.
Right. Bruce Springsteen and James Taylor, Jackson Browne, Graham Nash, Bonnie Raitt, Carly Simon.
All joined together, raise some money, raising awareness. I'm sure you've heard it many times. Yeah, you've heard it many times. Well, look, the public gets irritated when entertainers step out of those these invisible boundaries and start talking about political issues or stuff other than music.
Right. Well, you know, I would say when somebody stops the 300 tons per day of radioactive water leaking into the Pacific Ocean from Fukushima, when somebody figures out a way to stop that, come talk to me then. You know, or when somebody figures out a way to actually dispose of, quote unquote, nuclear waste in a safe way that you can look to your children and their children and so on and say, don't worry, we've got it taken care of. Or when somebody comes out a way to absolutely certainly prevent nuclear material from falling into the hands of a terrorist. You know, there are these problems that remain. And you know, there's still leakage from Chernobyl. There still is a, you know, a giant sarcophagus being, another one being put over the first one. And it's like a huge enterprise rolling this great big huge building on top of the building that was covering the building that melted down and blew up. So
it's almost like the decisions about, I know these are tender topics. We just went through a brutal election and everyone's nerves are raw. But it almost seems like despite whatever political officials might say about what direction our energy future might hold, or whether we're going to build any more nukes, or we're going to mine this, or we're going to power that, the market might make the decision for us. I mean, the advances in solar and geothermal and wind are such that it might not be in the hands of politics anymore.
Well, this is true. I've learned that the cost of wind power in this country is half that of coal-generated electricity. The price in Germany of renewables, wind and solar, went into the negative this year for 2 days, so that for 2 days you could get paid for using electricity in Germany. Portugal put their entire nationwide grid on wind and solar for 5 consecutive days this summer because they didn't need any of their conventional power plants because the wind farms and the solar farms were doing the entire job. So this is not something that's far off in the future. It's actually here. And the Chinese have invested in and purchased actually more than half of the solar manufacturing capacity in the world. So they think it's the wave of the future. And I suggest that we invented these things. I mean, we used to power satellites on solar energy and, you know, send up solar panels with them. And it'd be a shame if we got left behind on that technology when we basically started it.
Well, I just mean like with nuclear energy, for example, the debate still rages. People have strong opinions one way or another. But I mean, nobody's building nuclear power plants, not in the U.S. anymore. I mean, there are people who'd like to, but I don't know who's going to put up the money to build one when you could put it into solar and not have all the same kind of issues.
Right. I would agree with that. And we'll see. I mean, it's a very, no industry of that size dies easily. But, you know, when you talk about, oh, what about the jobs? What about the people you're putting out of work? You know, when people talk to me about, or I read about, the war on coal, I think about coal's war on us, in that there have been hundreds of thousands of deaths in the Northeast, and I don't know how to quantify them going back over time, but deaths from it, from asthma and emphysema and other respiratory diseases or early heart attacks and deaths that were caused by breathing soot, breathing carbon black, breathing ground level emissions, particulates. There's been so much damage to all the lakes here and also to our lungs by sulfur dioxide and nitrous oxide into acid when they combine with rain. it's well known that the whole acid rain problem in the Northeast killing the fish was pretty much solved by putting in scrubbers. And in the beginning, the industry went, oh, no, the scrubbers are so expensive, they're going to kill our business and put everybody out of work. Well, it was the opposite. They hired twice as many people because they had to have somebody build the scrubbers. Somebody had to design them and install them and build them. And there was a whole sub-business creating and building and installing scrubbers. So basically any new twist in the road causes a industry you had not imagined before coming up and creating a new kind of job. So I'm an optimist. This book, Stole the One, Rock and Roll Journey to Congress and Back, is an optimistic book at the beginning and at the end. And I can say after this election, and you probably gathered by things I've said, I was a Democratic candidate. I ran as a Democrat. I served two terms in the Democratic caucus in the House of Representatives. And, you know, I was not expecting for Donald Trump to be our president-elect, but I'm also capable of seeing a longer view and imagining that, first of all, imagine this, I don't know everything. It's like, I remember saying, we'll never survive the second term of Reagan. I remember saying, we'll never survive the second term of Nixon. Which
and a lot of people said the same about Obama. We're never going to make it through two terms of Obama.
And what the point is that our country is resilient. And my parents said to me and my brothers that they wondered after the Cuban Missile Crisis if they had made a mistake having children. You know, and now here we are. I'm a grandfather. I'm worrying about my great-granddaughter.
Let me ask you this.
Got a little girl herself, you know, and I'm Gampa. So I just try to do the best I can. And in the meanwhile, my real talent that was given to me is, I think, is making music and keeping the people happy. And so I try to do that as much and as well as possible, and also take care of my family, which is an obligation that all men have. So,
we got about a minute left. Does Orleans still? You still do?
We
still
do.
Play here
Orleans
and there.
Orleans is going out on a cruise this March called the Rock and Romance Cruise. It's a Time Life endeavor, and leaving from Fort Lauderdale, stopping in Cozumel before it goes off for other ports of embarkation. And Orleans, Peter Frampton, America, Firefall, Ambrosia, Stephen Bishop, Player.
Well, that sounds like fun. John,
a ton of other, you know, 70s, 80s bands that sort of go in the same genre, you might say, that we do.
We didn't have time to get into some of the stories about the collegiality in Congress, but there's some funny moments where people realize you're the guy, members of Congress who realize that their fellow member of Congress is a rock star and they ask for autographs. And another time where you sit around and play guitars with other members of Congress from both parties. And I took some kind of positive signs from that, and that there is a possibility that people can get along and work together. John Hall, I enjoyed the book, Still the One, A Rock and Roll Journey to Congress and Back, and I hope we get a chance to talk to you again. Thanks very much.
Thank you, George.
Talk to you again. Coming up, we're going to switch gears. Paul and Ben Eno, the hosts of Behind the Paranormal, a radio show. It's also the title of a new book that explores multiple kinds of paranormal topics that we've discussed on this program from time to time, and kind of tying them all together into what I've asked for a number of times, a unified theory of weirdness. This is a song that John Hall wrote, taking us into the break, and I think you'll recognize it. We'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM.